Stephen, welcome. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You are the founder of the Voice Care Center and also an integrative therapist at the Center for Mental Wellness. You provide low-cost, student-led mental health services that are accessible to all, and you promote multidisciplinary mental health journeys. Can you tell us a bit about how you got started in the world of mental health and also vocal health?
Yeah, so vocal health was first, and I got a coaching on The Voice in Belgium really early on in my singing teaching career, like 6 months in. Massive imposter syndrome, thinking, okay, I've got to know something here. I've got to learn something. I've got to catch up with these guys who've been doing it years. And in the kind of 10-minute slots that we had with each participant, what I started to notice was that if I was just quite nice to them, and if I listened and kind of just attended to them, I guess. There was no fancy vocal coaching techniques. There was no, you know, Rossini scales. There was none of that. Just me and them chatting about what it might be like to be going out live to 5 million people. Now, I didn't have any training in counseling, psychotherapy. I barely had any training in coaching, to be honest, at that stage. So I was like, oh, okay, this is a bit fun. Anyway, I did a good enough job and came back to London and began to think about how else I could have helped these people. So I started looking at all kinds of like quick fix stuff. Like if I only had 10 minutes with someone, could I make a profound change? And at that point in time, I was going to master classes where I would see these master teachers do one little thing, you know, hold the back of somebody's head and then their whole sound would change. And I'd just think, I want to do that. And basically, cut a long story short, that led me down the path of retraining as a clinical massage therapist and developing and synthesizing research as a primary researcher in vocal massage and manual therapy. So we've got three studies published in Journal of Voice, Journal of Singing and Voice Speech Review. So that's pretty cool. I have a special interest in acid reflux and how that may or may not, first of all, exist and secondly, present itself, which is a whole other topic that we could go into, but not for today. And backtrack. So mid-pandemic, I was living in London with my wife and my son, who at that point was not quite 1 year old. And I had to close the Voice Care Center. So I had at that point 10 staff members. I had to close the Voice Care Center. At that point, there wasn't a furlough scheme going on to offset your employees' income. Yeah. So I was about 40,000 quid in debt. And I just thought, I'm not sure what to do here. Anyway, cut a long story short, a couple of really key people came into my life at that point or offered their help and managed to make everything good again. And I worked my arse off as well. But in that period of me having minus money, thinking I was going to go to prison because I couldn't pay a VAT bill, with a young family, having lost our house in London and moving to live in my mother-in-law's garage and sleeping on the garage floor, I felt like I wasn't doing very well. So I'd heard of this thing called therapy, and I thought, oh, I wonder if I could maybe speak to somebody about this. So I went to see a performing arts specialist psychotherapist online, and within one session, I would say I felt 70% better. And what happens is people profoundly change as a result of being able to ask for help. Because as somebody who outwardly was running successful businesses, had a successful profile, and material things, lovely car, lovely family, it feels difficult. It felt difficult to me back then to go, I'm not okay here. this is not working for me. So I think the asking for help really congruently, massive thing. I had about 25 sessions of therapy in that period of time. And my therapist said to me, you need to buy a book. You need to buy a book and you need to read the first chapter only. I said, okay, fine. And the book was Alice Miller's The Drama of Being a Child. And the title of the chapter of the first chapter is Gifted Children and Why We Become Psychotherapists. I thought, why am I reading this? Going through and I thought, gosh, this sounds a lot like me. This sounds a lot like the kind of shit I went through and the things I had to conquer. And also, you know, a very fortunate, privileged support network and the ability to transcend ideas and think a bit systemically. And so I thought, fuck it, I'll apply to become a therapist. I'll apply to do the training, a 3-year training. And I finished the training April the 27th this year. And it has been the single most difficult thing I have ever done. Most profound and most difficult. I have 2 kids. One of them who I suspect has quite a profound presentation of ADHD. I have moved during a pandemic. I've had businesses rise and fall, collapse and otherwise. And nothing, not one single thing, has been as difficult as some of the moments in that training. Because when you train as a therapist, the theory is out there and what's in here is what you're training. Not too dissimilar to a voice in a way. It's like, sure, you can know about TA and LCA and, you know, Bernoulli and Boyle's law and all of that and, I don't know, acoustics. But like, sure, but can you actually bridge your voice? Right? You know, great, I'm so happy for you that you can cite all that. And how's your first bridge? You know. What ends up happening, or what ended up happening to me through this process, was a kind of death and rebirth, time and again through the training, to come into a place where I could really sit and go, I think I'm empty enough now that when a client says, I need your help, I can really sit there and say, how? How can I help? And really mean it. So that was my journey into it, really. And on the way, I've begun to synthesize lots of thoughts and lots of crossover. And you know, I'm a researcher. So part of my whole vibe, in a way, is looking at when somebody makes a claim and says X equals Y, I need to know why they're saying it, who said it, what they stand to gain out of it, and why that becomes, you know, general public social psyche opinion, and in the present day, the Centre for Mental Wellness, which is my latest venture, providing low-cost therapy for people, and also multidisciplinary plans, right through from psychiatric diagnosis to spiritual life coaching, which is an absolute vibe. You know, the idea that at each point, there's evidence to suggest that each thing works, but not everybody heals the same. Now I'm going to shut up.
Wow. You know, thank you so much for being so vulnerable to share that, because I think a lot of us can relate. Not only do we have day-to-day struggles in life and the human experience can be challenging, the pandemic itself was challenging. But I love the resilient story around that, because it gives us hope in that when we turn our energy towards self-care and getting the help we need, it can be really powerful and we can change our lives for the better. You talked a little bit about not everybody healing the same. And so I'd love to know your thoughts about the different therapeutic practices and how one can find out what best suits their healing journey.
Yeah, well, I guess the first thing to say is none of them are true. They're all just a story.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the, do you know the DSM-5, the Diagnostical Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, number 5, right?
Yes.
One of the kind of main critical thoughts of that diagnostic manual, which, you know, says you will have ADHD if blah, 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 right? One of the thoughts is, if that manual was burned, if humanity ended and a new race of humans came up, would we write the same diagnostic manual?
Good question.
I mean, yeah. And here's the thing, is we would probably find that the law of thermodynamics could be rediscovered. Would we rediscover depression? Because there's loads of thoughts about what depression might be. Is it, well, we know now that it's not an imbalance of chemicals in the brain, but that still gets touted around in the social psyche, you know, or my, you know, I need antidepressants to balance my brain chemicals. Well, it's not that simple. Is it a social affect? You know, when I go to my friend whose mum's dying of whatever and I feel really low, well, is that depression or is that social affect? You know, do I have to have it for a certain period of time before it means something clinically? And when, for example, in the cycle of grief, when am I depressed versus grieving? It's all untrue. And yet, it's all really important. And all those stories really matter. Because somebody might come into the Center for Mental Wellness and be presenting with anxiety. Maybe they've got a diagnosis from their GP of anxiety, right? One of the things that I'm thinking about is why now and why here? Why is this the point where this person has felt that they're able to reach out for help? Is it that the anxiety has got too much? Do they need to deal with the anxiety, or do they need to deal with the feeling about the anxiety, or do they need to deal with their life? Now, I don't know, that's the work, right? That's what we try and discover. But on the surface of it, anxiety, evidence-based says cognitive behavioral therapy equals success, is politicized. And as I come back to being a researcher, somebody who tries to critique and really understand what as best the truth is, it's difficult for me to really say that being a transactional analyst versus a psychoanalyst versus a Jungian psychologist versus a integrative counselor versus a therapeutic life coach versus a faith healer are any different to one another. The thing that comes up in the studies time and again, though, is that if you and your therapist have a really good relationship, newsflash, you get better. And that's not so different from singing teachers. If the therapeutic in psychotherapy's case, if the therapeutic relationship is good enough, you will heal.
Yeah.
It might take years. That doesn't mean the therapist is no good. That doesn't mean that you're not doing therapy right.
Like the power of human connection, right?
Boom. But bordered. Because the thing about a therapist is I really believe that a good therapist has incredible, kind and firm boundaries. There's no call me at 3 a.m. when you're out on the piss eating a kebab.
Yeah.
None of that. That's not the time for it. You know, phone your ex and have that conversation and then bring that to therapy.
Right.
Because the therapist, yeah, and I could talk about this forever as well, but I'm going to be brief. I think that therapeutic interaction, the depth of the relationship is only as good as the container that it's in. You turn up at this time, we finish at this time, I see you this often, I cost this much, these are my terms, this is what I do, and I will listen to you and be with you unequivocally for that time. And that's the container.
Yeah, having that good sense of boundaries. You know, something you just touched on there, I wanted to ask you about, because a lot of people think that singing lessons can replace therapy, or, you know, and while I believe that singing itself is therapeutic, would you agree that sometimes people are reluctant to go to therapy, but might use a lesson or a singing lesson for therapy?
Yes. I mean, yes. And that's why I, much to the discernment of some of my colleagues in the field, set up the Counselling for Singing Teachers 12-week course. Because I do believe that not everybody heals the same. And people coming to good, empathetic listeners like singing teachers, I think it's important that singing teachers have the skills by which not only they can help the client in those early stages, but also to protect their own intrapsychical selves and not take it on. And you know, basically, there are three steps in which you do that. When somebody discloses something, you listen, you hold a silence until they're done, and then you just reflect back what they've said. No opinion. No, oh yeah, that happened to me as well. It's like, no. Because if you only use their words, none of yourself goes into it. It sounds like you're telling me that. Earlier on today, somebody was, you know, looking at you a bit funny and that made you feel a bit odd. Is that right? Yeah, that's exactly right. Gosh, that sounds like it was really difficult for you. It doesn't need to be any more complex than that. And putting that, rather than, God, you know, that happens to me a lot. Boom, you're in it. So part of my thing about, you know, singing can be, yeah, therapeutic, but it isn't therapy. I think that's true. And I think we should be protecting ourselves as practitioners in that. So those are my thoughts. And I think, you know, singing is part of therapy. I think it has been since the dawn of time. I remember reading, I'm going to butcher this now, but I think it was in the wake of the Rwandan genocide. And the British Psychoanalytic Society sent over 50 analysts to help with the grief, right? And they were all sent back within a week. And the letter that came back from their, you know, head of state was, you sat us in dingy rooms with white men and asked us to talk about our feelings, and there was no fire, no drumming, no dancing, and no wailing. And you call this therapy? I get that. I mean,
there's something
fuck, you know,
vocalization of
yes
right?
Yeah, and you know, yeah. you that real tribal connection to self, but to others, it takes a village to grieve.
Absolutely.
And yet we grieve in silos.
Yes, absolutely. You know. Do you think in today's world that connection is missing? You know, I think there's been quite a few articles written about loneliness and isolation and how we're becoming, you know, glued to our phones instead of connecting with others. Do you think that's the missing link?
No, I don't think it's about connecting with others first. I think it's about connecting to ourselves first. I think there's a, I don't know what to call it, but like a TikTok defense that happens, which is it's all out there. It's all the problem of the phone or the problem of the thing. But we've had problems connecting to ourself, capital S, ever since the dawn of time. And that's what some of our greatest thinkers and writers and artists and musicians have tried to do. You know, you watch interviews with David Bowie and they say, you know, are you a singer? And he's like, I'm not a singer. I'm a fucking philosopher, mate. I'm just trying to tell you how it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and so I think it becomes interesting because if we externalize the agency, we take away the ability to change within ourselves, I think. You know, waiting for something else. Because newsflash, if the phone is the thing that's kind of being blamed, as it were, or social media is the thing that's being blamed, it becomes easy to demonize it. And therefore, we push it away. A little bit like when I had a tooth infection over Christmas. And like, I'm always like, oh, my teeth, clean my teeth, right? That's what I would say. But as soon as it become painful, it wasn't my tooth, it was that tooth. Well, how weird is that? I don't say I'm going to clean them teeth. That's weird. But as soon as it got painful, I othered it. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Like, that doesn't belong to me, in an effort to maybe diminish the pain or diminish my experience.
You know, we can use social media and our platforms to our advantage, can't we?
Yes. And I hope that's what I'm trying to do with Center for Mental Wellness, which is I do, you know, reels frequently enough that they might be it might be interesting to follow me. But stuff that is old wisdom or new research, and usually they're saying the same thing, by the way, you know, stuff that is inviting the person watching that reel to change or to take on somehow the teaching within it. Because I think often there isn't the invitation to change. Yeah. This is how it is. End of. That's not true. That's not how it is. This is not how it is.
Yeah.
I could just punch through that window. I'm not going to, but you know what I mean? It's like, none of this is how it is. Yeah. So, yeah.
You know, I love that you brought up your posts because, and that's on your Center for Mental Wellness Instagram page. In one post, you talked about getting into nature and how it impacts our mental health. I would love for you to share a bit more about that.
Yeah, so there's a couple of complex things about being in nature. The first, and maybe I'll bring the biopsychosocial model in here.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that too.
Yeah, I'll use it for this. So I love the biopsychosocial model. I love including it. It's my hope that if I've done nothing else with my life, that I've brought the attention of singing teachers to biopsychosocial philosophy through my work at Vocal Health Education. That's what I really hope. In terms of what it is, bio being the material, the makeup, psycho being the mind, emotions, thoughts, feelings, social being the stuff that's out of us. And all of that interacts. It's like eggs, flour, and milk. All of it comes together and makes the pancake. But you can't unmake a pancake. You never get the eggs back, right? So biopsychosocial is one word and it happens as one thing. Now, being out in nature is a biopsychosocial intervention for mental wellness, because if we're upping our vitamin D, we're going to feel happier. If we're outside and we can hear birdsong, we can hear rustling of leaves. These are all bits that light up certain parts of our brain, old parts of our brain. If we can see the horizon, our amygdala knows we're safe. That's a very ancient thing. Like, we weren't meant to have these huge buildings around us. And sometimes when somebody comes to me with a voice problem, and you know, they've had this show and they've had a phonotraumatic event in the show, and then the costume person's bullying them because the wig is heavy, and then they've been experiencing this hoarseness for a while, so they got a nebulizer but they didn't clean it properly, and then they got a bacterial infection, and then, you know, and then they come to me and they've just watched Ricky Gervais on Netflix being transphobic, and then I just wonder whether it's a voice problem. And you know, I will often open up a conversation that goes something like, "What's the last time you weren't in a city?" It's like, "Oh, crap, I can't remember." Or "When was the last time you just saw the sea? When was the last time you just saw horizon all the way around you, 360 degrees? Oh, I went to, you know, Brighton, which is a seafront city here." And it's like, "Yeah, but that's still a city. When was the last time you got lost in the woods? I mean, when was the last time you were without your phone? When was the last..." You know, I just wonder whether this is a voice problem or not. Now, I'm not taking away from the experience. Absolutely not. Because if somebody says they have a voice problem, they have a voice problem, end of. The same with anything. Experience is to be believed, in my opinion. So, you know, I don't want that bit of chat misconstrued as, "Oh, well, Stephen doesn't think voice problems exist." Not true. But I do think that getting out in nature is something that is natural to us. And so the opposite of natural is unnatural. So we're sitting down, we're on Zoom, we're living our lives doing whatever we're doing, and not out in nature. So that's weird to our brain. And of course, the sociological bit is, sure, you know, take 2 weeks off the show unpaid. No, not going to do that. I've got rent to pay, I've got bills to pay, people to see, cocktails to drink, life to live. So you see how that biopsychosocial thing all interacts. It's like, you know, and then we get a problem.
Yeah, you've given me a lot to think about here. And I think for those listening that are voice teachers, you know, when somebody comes to you with a voice problem, I think looking at it holistically is really important.
Totally. One of the critiques of my work at the moment, as it were, is like, "Well, Stephen, aren't you muddying the waters between what's therapy and what's teaching?" And my invitation to them is, show me the line. You know, really draw that line and commit to it. Because if I change one little bit of the interaction, that line shifts, sometimes by a massive amount. So beyond teaching and therapy, human interaction, one-to-one, how do we make that as safe as possible? Well, I think there's something important about being trauma aware, not asking questions beyond your own competence to hold the answer. Could you hold that? Could you hold that without it affecting you? If no, don't pursue that line of inquiry, even if it's what you might be thinking. Only inquire to what you can hold. Because if you can't hold it, when they've shared it, they will only receive shame. So I think, you know, work within your confidence and competence, and only inquire as to what you believe you can yourself hold.
That's great advice. And, you know, one of my passions as a vocal coach is educating my clients on the importance of voice care. And I know that recently you launched a Voice Care for Singers course.
Yeah, so Voice Care for Singers is in vocal health education. So vocal health education is a charity that I set up with Dr. Ginevra Williams, who is a wonderful colleague and dear friend of mine now. We had a vision of what would it be like if every singer, voice coach, musical director, blah, 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 on the planet had a basic idea of the biopsychosocial model and how that might relate to voice. We have now nearly 2,500 vocal health first aiders worldwide, which is really cool. And the Voice Care for Singers course was born out of the idea that the vocal health first aid is quite applicable to coaches and teachers, but not necessarily to singers themselves. Although, you know, I think it is. It kind of doesn't say that on the tin. No. And so the Voice Care for Singers is like a basic run through of biopsychosocial practice for your own instrument. And it's cool. It's just cool. It's lovely. It's fun. It's evidence-based. It's, you know, well-researched, well put together. And lots and lots of people have done it. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people around the world have done it, and the feedback's been great. So if you know you're a singer listening to this, I would encourage you to go over to vocal health education and have a look.
In your recent posts, you talk about authenticity, spirituality, mental wellness, and healing. What are some tips you can give to performing artists who may be struggling or have struggled with their mental health and would like to get started on their healing journey?
This is tough because it's addressing a whole population. And there are loads of factors here. So whoever's listening to this, take this how you hear it and use it only for you. And whatever jumps out at you, hold that lightly. So I think the first thing is, if a performer, if a singer, if an artist is struggling with their mental health, first of all, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. The systems are against us. How difficult is it to survive as an artist? And particularly when people will say, well, the struggle makes it all worth it. If you actually look at that as a sentence, that is so toxic. Because in a reverse engineered way, we can go from the struggle makes it all worth it to I will work for free to struggle, just to get known, just to get my foot in the door, just to burn out. And so I think there's a nuanced presentation here, which is it's not your fault and you have autonomy. You have more autonomy than you think. If you are struggling to create art, if you're a singer-songwriter and you haven't written a song, if you're an artist and you haven't painted a picture, if you're a writer and you haven't written a piece of literature, take a break. Go away for a while. Remove yourself. Remove yourself from your art and do something completely different. See what happens. And then come back to it. The important thing is coming back to it, right? You know, if you're an artist, don't leave. We need you. We need art, yeah? But that can take all kinds of forms. What gives us inspiration is so different, you know, person to person. There's an Aramaic poem which talks about genius, you know, from like the 4th century BC, that talks about genius. And where we get the word genius from is the word genie, which is like a spirit. And one of those things is about the genius is the genie of creativity. So I sit down to write my epic novella and nothing. All that means is the genie didn't visit me today, rather than shit, I've got writer's block. You see the difference?
Yeah. You know, Stephen Pressfield talks about the muse and how he needs to call upon that muse before he starts writing. He has sort of like a spiritual practice, and he's talked about it on podcasts. And I think that's kind of, you know, that's the missing element here, is going a little deeper, would you say?
Yes, because there is, now I'm gonna be careful how I say this, because I wanna get it really right. There is a movement happening in the social psyche, which moves to phase deep spiritualism rather than a spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And getting in an ice bath and breathing will do all kinds of wonderful things to your neurotransmitters, will do all kinds of wonderful things to your mechanoreceptors, will do all kinds of wonderful things for your liver and your whatever. And it's part of something.
It's like having some kind of ritual that,
yes,
you know, I think human beings in today's world, we're kind of missing that, aren't we? Like for some people, it might be journaling, it might be lighting a candle, it might be, like you said, taking a walk in nature to get that source of inspiration or that depth.
But I can't stress enough that it can't be for Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I'm going to plunge into the ice bath for my followers, and then they're going to see how spiritual I am. That is the antithesis of spiritual practice.
Yeah.
Spiritual practice is practice for your spirit, not for your followers. And I say that with no pejorative judgment. You know, this is, I get making content is important. I get putting yourself out there and showing your commitment to yourself and your body and your art is important. I really get that. And just make sure that the spiritual bit is actually being nourished. You know, Carl Jung said, we can only heal to the depths at which we ourselves have been healed. I think that's as true in singing teaching, as it is in therapy, as it is in art.
Yes.
And I don't mean that this has to be a painful process. It can be beautiful. It probably will be painful, but it will be beautiful. And, you know, I just think that with the decrease in religious practice, generally we've lost a sense of quiet contemplation about something bigger than ourselves. You know, and I say that as a profound agnostic. You know, I cannot commit to one God or one idea. I'm not sure about it. But what I am sure about is that there is something bigger than me and you. Now, you know, whether I look at the traditional Chinese medicine practitioners who I know and they call that qi, that's cool for me. Whether I talk to my Christian friends and they call that God, capital G, that's cool for me. It's all fine. If we don't have something bigger than ourselves out there, can we ever transcend ourselves? And isn't that what art is calling us to do, is to transcend the physical form in a way, to go outside of ourselves, to gather something from somewhere else that nobody else has done? You know, one of the posts I did about authenticity was when Martin Heidegger, who was the great philosopher, was asked, how do we reclaim a sense of authenticity? He said, just spend more time in graveyards.
I love that.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. I don't spend enough time in graveyards.
Yeah.
Because this body isn't here for long. You know, that's profound to me.
Huge.
And, you know, one of the things that I just want to touch on and weave in here is that I'm an ADHD clinical services provider, a CSP. If you know, it's like one of those, you know, you see all the post-nominals after somebody's name.
You've quite a few letters after your name, I've noticed.
I do.
That's great.
You know, one day I'll get rid of them all when I've done the work on my own ego, but I'm not there yet. Because all 36 of them or whatever it is took me a while to get. So one of the things about ADHD and the present moment is that ADHD is communicated sometimes as like a gift, right? Like you have the gift of ADHD, and I think that's really damaging. Because I think it gifts us things. But in and of itself, it is a disorder. And I'm really clear about that because I think there's something happening in the TikTok world, which is that ADHD equals trauma. And that's not true. ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder. It's we can see it in the brain. The cingulate cortex, which is the bit that controls our movement, is much more advanced than the bit that controls our ability to have rational and consistent thought. And, you know, the difference between those, as we get older, probably becomes less, right? We become more able to cope with certain situations. But like in my four-year-old, massive difference, massive, massive difference. And one of those things that, you know, that being in the present, somebody with moderate to profound ADHD symptoms is only ever in the present because it's now or not at all. I think there's something really interesting about that in the prevalence of ADHD in performing artists. At the moment, the global population, the statistics say about 3 to 6% of Gen Pop have ADHD. That's still a huge amount. Huge amount. That's hundreds of millions of people. But the new studies now are looking like it's more like 11%. Now, that's nearly billions of people. And so I think that, and I wonder, again, it's a biopsychosocial thing. It's like I go into dancing because my parents realized I couldn't sit still. So they thought, okay, and I was loud. So I went into singing lessons. And then I got discipline from ballet, but it was harmful discipline. Or I got told to shut up by my peers because I was singing too loud. But then we start to look at the life story of somebody and go, this might all be because, newsflash, your brain is different. Do you have that thing where you go, okay, I've got 5 minutes to leave, and then you look up at the clock again and you go, fuck, I should have left 15 minutes ago. What Barclay calls time blindness. We only have the now. And so I think there's something really interesting about presentness and clinical presentations, neurodevelopmental disorders, etc. You know, I think we have a duty to communicate that maybe some people are actually better at being in the now than others on a fundamental architecture of the brain level. ADHD, there are three types: hyperactive, inattentive, or mixed. And the person who is an inattentive ADHD, the person who goes right in, world's rushing past them, they can't, you know, they get overwhelmed, they get muddled, they can't, you know, is very different to the person who, like my mother-in-law, comes into the house and she hasn't taken her coat off and she's already done the washing up, she's got the Hoover out, she's cooked a bit of, and I'm like, what, you've just walked in the house? Oh yes, yes, lots to do, always stuff to do, isn't there? Is there?
Wow.
The hyperactive side, right?
Yeah.
And then the mixed presentation is more nuanced and more difficult to diagnose often, because it's not picked up as hyperactive, and it's not picked up as you're shut down from the world. Sometimes it's just picked up as you're a bit annoying and socially unacceptable.
Yeah. Do you think that having a diagnosis or having a label is important? How important is it for people?
I used to think it wasn't important, and now I think it is important. I think it is important because we live in systems. And each system that we live in, the system of this earth, the system of employment, the system of medicine, the system of social hierarchy, the system of our family,
gotcha,
requires us to, you know, attend to certain things. Mm-hmm. And if one system, i.e. the medical system, puts us, you know, somebody with a bigger degree than me puts a stamp on a bit of paper which says, you have this. First of all, it means you're going to be able to access medication. And if somebody was diabetic, you wouldn't disallow them insulin. You wouldn't do that. And yet there's a weird stigma thing about ADHD, which is, oof, yeah, oh, I wouldn't take Ritalin if I were you. That'll really fuck you up. It's like, what are you saying? We've got these amazing, really super smart people. All right, in a pharmaceutical system, which is driven for profit, yes, I can see that. And I'm not so sure that the biochemists working on the floor of the lab to make the thing that helps you balance and live a better and more risk-free life and live 11 to 18 years on average longer, by the way, if you take ADHD medication, then I'm not sure that person really gives a fuck about the whole pharmaceutical doodah, right? They're there to do their job. And so I think, you know, that again, it's nuanced, but I would say diagnosis for ADHD is important, because at some point, somebody in your life is going to go, well, just suck it up and do it. And you've got to put in a firm boundary and say, my brain doesn't work that way.
That's an incredible perspective. And this has been so enlightening, Stephen. I just want to make sure our audience knows, like, where can they find you?
So they can find me on Instagram at Center for Mental Wellness. And then the clinic that I run in central London and internationally online is at Voice Care Center. So those are the two places. If you're experiencing a problem with your voice, we believe you. You can come and see us at Voice Care Center. If you're experiencing a problem with your mental health, we believe you. And you can come and see us at the Center for Mental Wellness.
Fantastic. Stephen, once again, thank you so much. I loved this conversation and I hope to have you back on.
I would love to. Thanks so much for having me.